596 rule one.
Group Captain Mahadi, reel one. Could you tell me what your recollections are of the day that war broke out, as far as you personally were concerned?
Well, oddly enough, I can, vividly. I'd been in the Air Force some 10 years, man and boy, from Halton, and I returned in the mid-30s from a tour in the Middle East, almost the far Middle East, from Baghdad, in fact. I'd served 5 years as a sergeant pilot, which was a stint that we did at that time. In other words, a sergeant pilot was only served for 5 years, and then he went back to his trade. And I'd been a metal rigger, trained, as I said, at Halton. And we were all foregathered, oddly enough, officers and sergeant pilots, and that wasn't a mix in those days. In the Air Force of the 30s, up until the outbreak of war, we were very much two very separate people. And this had nothing to do with skills. The sergeant pilot, and you've probably heard in many other ways, the sergeant pilot was a very much revered person. After all, he was a product of the Air Force. In the main, he was an ex-Halton apprentice. He was a tradesman, and he came by way of a very, very difficult selection. To be a sergeant pilot in those days, and I was very, very lucky because I didn't get it through any academic reason. In fact, I left school, as you saw probably in my CV, I left school at the age of 13. So really, I was educated by Halton, educated by the Air Force, and for the Air Force. That's very important. So when we sat there, the officers, all the pilots, because there was no other form of air crew then, if we had a wireless operator, or indeed a gunner in the Whitley days, they were just airmen, tradesmen airmen, and the tradesmen airmen were working at their skills on the aircraft, and then they downed their tools and climbed the aircraft. There was no sergeant aircrew, navigators. Why? Aircrew NCOs didn't come for a later period in the war. Not immediately. And so the officers, the pilots, listened to the Prime Minister intoning in his bleak, dreary way, "I have sent a telegram to Germany, to Hitler, and up to the moment, I've had no reply. We are now at war with Germany." Now, there is nothing like, I believe, the 1914 feeling, the euphoria, the cheering. "We'll all be over by Christmas. We'll be home by Christmas." There was none of that. There was just a wonderful feeling of, well, it's come. It's at last. Here we are. We're at war. We'd had about a year of phoniness. We from Munich. This is peace in our time. The little bit of paper fluttering. But it was. We haven't even today learned how vital that year was to us. So we all just sat there and thought, and in 3, 4, 5 minutes, the sirens went. And that alerted everybody.
Where were you?
At Driffield in Yorkshire, with 77 Squadron on Whitley's. We had one of the earliest of, we were one of the earliest of the Whitley squadrons, and I being the senior sergeant and the senior pilot, when I joined the squadron, it had only a couple of sergeant pilots, and I was just at the end of my 5-year period, just at the end, the very end, and 4 rookie acting pilot officers who'd just come from flying training school. So I was rather like the subaltern in the regiment, or the senior subaltern who comes into the mess and he thunders, "Who put those bloody flowers there?" And one subaltern, the senior subaltern, jumps up to attention and said, "Sir, the CO's lady." And he says, "Oh, how charming, how delightful." And so I am the senior pilot, despite my lowly rank, at the end of my 5 years. And so I become this senior subaltern. I'm the officer in charge of photography, small p and small o. I'm the officer in charge of training, although I'm not CFS. I get a CFS category later. I'm the officer in charge of a host of things, because none of the AP acting pilot officers are deemed worthy of having any role like that. So I'm something of the regimental sergeant major in a way, which was very good for my training. And so the first night I take pamphlets to Germany.
You said that there was the air raid warning.
The air raid warning, yes. I'm sorry, I'm just going ahead of my... An air raid warning, and we all sort of troop off to the shelter very leisurely, but we, as the air raid warning gets more and more pertinent and more, somehow or other, it's more and more giving us a message. It's alarming. Our casual walk develops into a sort of trot, and we all cram the door of the shelter, get in, and that is the very first air raid warning of the war, which is, we now know the reason for it. It was a French air attaché coming back from leave, and he hadn't notified anybody, or he wasn't aware that we literally were at war, because I believe we went to war before France did, however. And we sit in the shelter, and I go back to my Halton days when I read every book that was written about World War One, and I believe, I assume a sort of attitude about Ball and Bishop and McCudden. But then a terrible feeling settles in my gut, which didn't leave until my commander-in-chief sent me a signal nearly 5 years later, and it said, "Personal for station commander, hostilities cease at midnight tonight." Now that same very same night, I took pamphlets in at the top of the Ruhr, right down through the Ruhr and out through the bottom, and I was accosted by Belgian fighters coming through Belgium, and they tried to force me down, because it's history now, and I've got a book there by John Colville that you've probably read, the Colville Diaries. You know, he was private, personal and private secretary to three or four prime ministers, and he spent most of the war with Churchill. And he mentions this in the call. I'll show it to you. I can't get out of this rig you've trapped me in.
What did you think about delivering leaflets instead of bombs?
I thought, I didn't think very highly about it. You know, there we were. We didn't know what to expect over there. I found one searchlight at Kiel, round about Kiel, where we went in, and another one round about Cologne, where I came out, right down through the Ruhr, which we later called Happy Valley, with maybe 10,000 or tens of thousands of guns and searchlights. And it was a lethal place to be in. We went right through, and I never fired my gun, and that probably saved me for a court-martial, because I landed, I was short of petrol, I landed at Manston, and I was put under arrest because a Whitley, the Belgians claimed that a Whitley had shot one of their fighters down, and apparently it did, but it wasn't me. And so that was my first sortie. And I did a tour, which I've just... I'm publishing a book in April, which I'm very disappointed about, because it's not what I wanted, but that should be my fault, because I didn't want to write a book about my war experience. That's a tiny bit of my life. However, we survived that, and then we survived 33 sorties when the Germans started coming through the Low Countries, and we were going to the Ruhr and trying to do something to stem this flood of Deutschers.
Could I just ask you about the Phoney War period? What kind of work were you doing during the Phoney War before the Germans attacked?
Pamphlets, or leaflets, as they were called then, just to trying to bring some sort of succor and sort of hope to the countries that we'd... I went also to Czechoslovakia, and I can't claim I was ever anywhere near Prague. I can only hope a friendly wind took my pamphlets near. I know they were in Czechoslovakia because of a back plot to land in France, as we did at a airfield we called Villeneuve, or Vino, V-E-N-O, or Villeneuve, in the centre of the Champagne province, of which we took great advantage of, because the French said, you can take as much champagne in cases, because the Boche will come and have it if you don't. And so I went through the pamphlet area, and then before the advent of the attack on the Low Countries, we did a lot of shipping, daylight shipping reconnaissance, and that was flying out in daylight to see if we could spot ships, and we went out until we sighted the Dutch coast. We were very low, and then we turned around and came home. So that was a very useless sort of thing. And then once the Low Countries were attacked, we were doing something like 15, 16, 7 sorties a month in that month of June. I think I did 17 sorties. And those were to the Ruhr, and trying to assist in some way or stem the advance, which we did nothing. Stavanger, when we went to Stavanger, and I think that was the only time I might claim I did anything worthwhile. Went down through cloud and we bombed the hangars at the Stavanger airfield. And then we did whatever we could in the way of bombing in the Ruhr.
Was that raid on Stavanger during the Norway campaign?
Yes. Yeah. That's when the campaign had started, and the Germans weren't really installed in force and we were trying to assist the British campaign in Norway. No, and I don't believe we did anything at all.
Do you know if you hid the hangars?
I have the remotest idea. We didn't have night cameras then, you see. And then I don't think we'd be high enough. See, the night camera used to be dropped later on when I come to my second tour and the Pathfinders. The night camera was dropped maybe from 18,000 feet and it burst about 4, 5, or 6 wherever it was detonated to burst, and then your picture, and that was timed for your bombs to arrive on the ground. And so bang went the photo flash, and bang went and the camera was timed because of the time to fall for the photo flash and the time for your bombs to fall. So in the Pathfinder era you came back with a picture and you didn't say, oh yes, I bombed the hangars at Stavanger, because you had no evidence. And a lot of people, well, I mustn't malign people, there were a lot of people that maybe truly felt they'd done some good. I never honestly believed, because I knew that my bomb aimer couldn't, with his hand on his heart, say, I saw the target and I bombed it.
So the relative lack of failure in those days was because of the lack of navigation,
well,
and bombing aids, was it?
This became so bad in 41 that Lord Charwell, Lindemann, Professor Lindemann, who was of course the personal scientific advisor to Churchill, although we had our own man, Tizard, Henry Tizard, I believe he was. Henry Tizard was the Air Force advisor, and these two fellows couldn't speak to each other. You know, they were horizontally opposed to everything each other said or did. And so, but it was becoming very obvious that we weren't finding our targets. We were not in any way achieving anything. And Lindemann got a person called Butt. I don't even know his other name. He was a civil servant, but he was very much the, what would you call him, an analyst, or he did a paper on some 600 photo prints of our bomb plots. And he came, have you read the Butt report?
No, but I know about it.
Well, you should read the Butt report. Now, I read the Butt report probably different to anybody else. And nobody has quarreled and nobody has taken me to task. And I claim the outcome of the Butt report, he was very, very generous to bomber crews. He said that the bomber crews in the period and the 600 photographs that he was analysing, he said the bomber crews were getting 3% of their weight within 5 miles of the aiming point, or they were getting 5% within 3 miles. Now, that's the way I read it. If you might read it quite differently, and others might, but I put that in my bombing years lecture, and no one, and I lecture at Smithsonian, and the Americans are not going to argue with that, because they were no better, despite them bombing into a pickle barrel with their Norden bomb sight. So this report was leaked to Whitehall. The Navy were desperate for bombers to help them with the submarine menace in the Western approaches. The Army were at their wits' end in the desert, And these two ganged up on the chiefs of the chiefs of staff and said, look, this bomber campaign is a waste of time, a waste, a terrible waste of our resources, and you're building up to a fabulous big bomber command. It's useless. And they were right. They were dead right. And they said, look, we can do better. Now, the Navy couldn't. And the type of aircraft we had at the time was useless for the Navy, because they couldn't reach the Black Pit. You know the Black Pit? That the middle of the Atlantic where the submarines congregated. They called that the Black Pit. Forgive me, I'm not teaching my nephew. You're not getting a history lesson here. I'm just... You should look at these. They couldn't reach the Black Pit and get back again to any effect. And they could do no better. They couldn't do as well as we did. Don't be too convinced about my assessment of the BUT report. I'm telling, I use this in my own telling of my story, the bombing years. And so, by this time, this report came out about the end of 41, but at this time, a guy called Harris, serving in the ministry, had been doing all sorts of things, including being in America on a purchasing mission for aircraft. And he came home, and he was the deputy chief or deputy assistant chief in, I won't quote exactly what it was, you would know, you'll find out what it was. He was number two at the Air Ministry under the CAS, but he had been designated as the next Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command, and this is in late 41, when everybody's arguing and there's a tremendous turmoil going on in Whitehall all the time. And so he knows. He knew all about the BUT report, knew all about, and he was very much closer to the Department of Bombing Operations in the Air Ministry, headed by an Air Commodore Baker, who became an Air Chief Marshal and a friend of mine later. And in fact, one person I'd like... Have you been to see Sid Bufton?
No.
Put that. You must. Now, I believe, and I'm still. Oh, I haven't lost you anything, have I?
No.
I believe Sid Bufton is coming out. He took a terrible sort of bashing from Harris. And he's the man, and I've got Harris's dispatches. Have you seen those?
Yes.
You've got a copy. You can read those, because you've got a copy. Good. I was going to loan you mine, because I signed for those when they came out at the end of the war, and say I've destroyed them. And I probably signed Eisenhower or Jimmy Doolittle, but I didn't sign Hamish Mahaley. And there they are.
You're saying Bufton got the bashing from Harris?
Yes, and he is the man who was plugging hard for a new unit called the Target Finding Marking Unit. It wasn't called Pathfinders. It was Harris that named them Pathfinders. And it was Harris that named Bennett, who had been one of his junior officers in the early 30s on a flying boat squadron. I'm not sort of elaborating too much, but
that's all right.
As long as we don't run out. So the great turmoil in Whitehall. The Navy were always and still are very pertinent, very strong, although they got the third share of the defence vote, and they always will, because that's their proper share, in my view. I'm very much the Harris man, bomb area bombing, because the other bombing, the American bombing, and I'm not going to go into that to any detail, but we were no more successful than ours. They should have come with us, which is something I tried to. I was seconded to Jimmy Doolittle, but I'll tell you something you might want to hear about that later. However,
so this, why did Bufton get such a hammering from Harris?
Because he's the person that was very much listened to in the Air Ministry by the Chiefs of Staff and by the Air Council of the day. It's now an Air Board, Air Council of the day. Listened to Sid Bufton. Baker let Sid Bufton do all the talking and all the shouting about, let's have this target finding, target marking unit, take the best of the bombers. And Harris said, I will not have a core elite. Well, however, Sid Bufton, and I think he's publishing a book, but that's just in brackets, you know, off the record.
So both Harris and Bufton wanted the marking, but it was just a question of whether...
Bufton and the Air Council were mad keen to have to overthrow this very strong feeling that we were useless, we were not finding our targets, and we certainly weren't bombing our targets. Now, that is Bufton speaking, you see, and we're talking of 1941, and this all comes to a head when the Budd report comes out. Now, I've got a copy of it, but you'll be able to get a copy quite easily. There must be one in the museum. I'm certain Noble had one. However, so this all comes to a head, and at the same time, in February 41, Harris is officially the Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command. And he knows what's going on in Whitehall because, you know, he was right in the middle of it. And the Navy, and to a lesser degree the Army, they've got this very strong anti-bomber command or bomber technique body, and a strong body in Whitehall. And once the Navy get their teeth into a thing like that, it's almost impossible to shake them off. Now, Harris shook them off. Now, you've heard, no doubt, Harris took over a bankrupt command, utterly bankrupt. It had less or no more than 300 aircraft, and there was just a handful